Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is writer and native Tulsan Roger Thompson. Today he's the director of the program in writing and rhetoric at Stony Brook University, but he was also once the founder and director of an environmental program in Banff, Alberta, home to a large thriving population of North American grizzly bears. It was while there he first heard about a population of brown bears, or grizzlies, located just 50 miles east of Rome, in the heart of the Apennine Mountains, the central spine of the Italian peninsula. It seemed hard to fathom. But in fact, there is a population of 40 or 50 brown bears that still reside there in close proximity to humans. While Americans battle today over whether to delist the grizzly bear from endangered and threatened species list, there's no doubt that this rare population of bears known as Marsican brown bears are endangered. It's included on the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's Red List for Endangered Species. And Thompson shares the stories of these bears in his book, No Word for Wilderness, Italy's Grizzlies and the Race to Save the Rarest Bears on Earth. It's published by Ashland Creek Press, and I spoke with him last week here in Tulsa. Roger Thompson, welcome back home to Tulsa, and welcome to Studio Tulsa.
Absolutely great to be here again.
Yeah. When I first saw your book, No Word for Wilderness, I was surprised to learn that, in fact, there are wild bear populations in Italy. Now, I know bears are very resilient species, but when I think of wildlife and places where they thrive, Italy is perhaps not the first place. How did you first learn about this grizzly bear population in Italy?
Well, that's the exact same reaction I had. I couldn't believe the first time I heard there were bears in Italy. I couldn't believe there were bears in Italy. It didn't make any sense. I actually learned about them when I was in the Canadian Rockies. I had gone out with a fellow by the name of Reno Sommerhalter, who's a bear naturalist and takes out people on bear sighting guided tours. And while we were out, we ran across a woman from Slovakia. Her name's Vladmira Lakova. And Vladmira, in the course of our conversation, just mentioned these bears in Italy. And I stopped the conversation and I was like, what bears in Italy? And I said, black bears. And she goes, no, brown bears. And I said, like grizzly bears. And she goes, yes. And I was incredulous. I couldn't believe it. Reno looked at me and I looked at Reno and I could tell he knew about these bears and we talked about them. And I kind of decided at that point that I wanted to go see these bears and figure out what the story was around them.
The title of your book, No Word for Wilderness, sort of points up the incredulity of this story because, in fact, in Italian, there is no word for wilderness.
Yeah, and it's not entirely unusual for some languages not to have a word for wilderness, but it is striking in Italy simply because most of us, especially Americans, when we think of Italy, we think of civilization, we think of art, we think of maybe travel to well-settled lands. And in fact, for the Italian mind, the idea of the wild and the way that we think of it as Americans, it doesn't really make much sense. They don't have a word. The closest they have are words that indicate kind of forest land. But in general, the kind of concept that, hey, do you want to go out camping into the wild? This is kind of quaintly American, or as they say in the book, Northern European. This is not something Italians look forward to doing. In general, there are, of course, exceptions.
So is there wilderness lands in Italy, though?
Well, it's a good question, and that's part of what I'm trying to make a case for in the book, or at least trying to point out. I shouldn't say I'm making the case. I'm trying to point out that the idea of what we think of as wilderness is it can be different. And what is so startling about the Italian landscape is that, you know, there really aren't places that are untouched in the way that we might think of parts of Alaska or even parts of the West. But there are areas where the settlements have been isolated or have been allowed to continue to grow and flourish despite the population around. So the result is there is a different type of wilderness, one that still has human footprint, but which has kind of come to be more integrated into the culture. Even if they don't think of it as something distinct from their lives in the way that we do, it is there. And there are wild animals, bears, wolves, chamois, which is a type of antelope, badgers. I mean, you name it. There's wild animals throughout Italy.
What I was surprised to learn was that, again, I didn't really think of the national park model going to a place like Italy. I know in certain other places, certainly less developed countries, national parks have become a part of the landscape. Even in further in northern Europe, there are quite a few national parks, but there are a sort of a spine of national parks through the mountain ranges in the middle of the Apennines in Italy.
Yes, and those, you know, Italy was kind of late to the game on the establishment of the national parks, but where these bears are in Italy, the Abruzzo bears, was actually the first national park in Italy, and it was formed in the 20s. It was, in fact, initially a hunting reserve, but over time, there was this kind of ethic toward preserving land that came to start being part of the national conversation, but it was later. The Northern Europeans, the Swedes, were one of the first. The Danes started thinking about wild land and how to preserve it. By the mid and late 20th century, Italy, mainly under the leadership of one guy by the name of Franco Tassi, who decided that at the time there was 1% of land dedicated to parkland in Italy, and he decided they should have a goal for 10% of the land. And it was successful. Some of the later national parks established in the 90s, including some really stunningly beautiful parks, are a result of a very deliberate campaign to preserve land.
Now, in fact, once you got to Italy, you found out there were not one population of brown bears or grizzlies. Yeah. There are actually two.
That's right. So there's a set of bears in the north of Italy. These bears, there used to be a indigenous group of bears that grew up and were part of the Italian Alps. The last one of those bears died in 2001, 2002. But that area of the Alps was seen as prime habitat for a targeted rewilding. This is a process by which people try to bring back some of the wild creatures or even sometimes the wild flora of an area and reestablish them in the area. So in northern Italy, they reintroduced grizzly bears, brown bears, from Slovenia. These are not native, but they have done well there until recently.
Now, when I think of Slovenia, I think that is like one mountain range over, really.
Yeah, exactly. It's not far at all, and that's why they were seen as such a good possibility, as a good fit at the time. And in some ways, they were. They thrived. There's no doubt. Lots of cubs born within the first couple of years, but their personality was not exactly the same for what the bears which had been there. And this can probably be, you know, really drawn out by contrast with the bears in the central Apennines, which are just 50 miles east of Rome. There's a remnant population of native Italian bears called the Abruzzo bears, Marsican bears. And these are special bears, and they're the last of their kind. And the book really is kind of focuses on them, though it sets up a contrast between the two types of bears to kind of drive home the point that the native bear needs to be preserved because it holds in its DNA a history that the northern bears don't have.
The Slovenian bears, to me, seem more like your typical brown bear, in which they don't do well around man. They really need wild space. Encounters with man are likely to end badly, ultimately for the bear, but for livestock around them. They will predate sheep or whatever's around if it's easier kill than something else.
That's right. And so the Slovenian bears, and this is not to demonize these bears, but they are a little bit more aggressive. They aren't as aggressive as, say, the American grizzly. They aren't, again, in general, bears are not dangerous animals. They're just like any animal that, you know, you learn to read and understand and give space to.
They're excellent foragers.
Yes, absolutely. And they are survivors. So they generally are okay. But sometimes the Slovenian bears, the transplanted bears, they have been used to a lot more space in Slovenia. And so coming into contact with humans, there have been some instances which have not been as soft as we'd want them to be. Now, whether they're really dangerous or not is another question. In general, you know, I think it's been a successful story, and there are plenty of people who support those bears, even if there are some who remain kind of scared of them, probably out of proportion to reality, what's needed.
Yeah. Now, contrast those bears with this Abruzzo or grizzlies. They're completely different. Yeah. As I was reading about them, it's just, well, of course, they're Italian bears. They're civilized bears. They're incredibly skittish of humans, mm-hmm. so they shy away from any human contact, even though they're in close proximity to
Absolutely.
Humans.
Absolutely.
And they've also adapted their diet to where they're basically herbaceous species.
Yeah, the scientists working with them like to just describe them as vegetarian bears. So they are the brown bears. They are a type of large apex mammal, yet they have almost an exclusively vegetarian diet and ants. They like ants a lot because of the protein content. Occasionally, you'll find meat in their diet, and if it is, it's usually small mammals like mice. Sometimes there's carrion, but they do not attack cattle, they do not attack sheep, they do not attack humans. In 1,000 years of recorded history, there's not been a single attack on a human. And this is in a country where there's great proximity and connection between human and bear. Abruzzo is a long settled land, and in that place, the Abruzzo people learn to live alongside the bear, not simply hunted, eliminated. In fact, part of the problem with this bear, with only 50 of them left, is that right now they're facing down threats from people who are not native to Abruzzo and don't understand the relationship, and in fact don't respect the relationship that's developed over 1,000 years with these bears.
So the population is pretty much adapted to this bear population.
Absolutely. That's what there's a wonderful phrase in Italian that's translated loosely called the nature tax. And the idea is that at some point in history, the Abruzzese, the local people in Abruzzo, the mountains of Abruzzo, decided that they weren't going to fight the bear, they weren't going to hurt the bear, that they weren't going to be in conflict forever with the bear. Instead, they're just going to live alongside the bear. So the idea of the nature tax is that if you were going to, say, have an apiary, you would put out an extra beehive or two for the bear. Or if you had apple trees, you'd plant a couple extra at the edge of your property. Those were the bear's apple trees. And the idea here is that you had to kind of pay nature for the right to work that land. This is a lovely idea. It's a really beautiful idea. And apparently the bears agreed with this idea, right? So you've got these bears living alongside people. They are very skittish. On the other hand, they don't see people as a threat either. They're oftentimes visible from roads. They'll just be lounging there, eating on wild celery or berries. People get out of their cars, take pictures, and then the bears ramble off. The younger ones are usually always very skittish and they don't want to see you.
Now, when I think of our bear species, if you put out an apple orchard in bear country, pretty much the bear says, "This is mine.
This is all mine."
So how does that work? Did you ask about that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think if that bear population were larger, there may be greater issues. But part of it is the fact that the Abruzzese have figured a way, the people who've lived there have figured a way or have understood the habits of the bear well enough after so long that they appreciate what it is that the bear needs and wants and offers it up without question initially, right? So once that need is met, the bear really doesn't care much about it. And the truth is the bear, yes, of course, they love certain things that are sweet, but they will seek out ants above a lot of other things. They will seek out certain types of berries above other things. It's their preferred diet. It's what they evolved with their entire lifespan of the bear. So, yes, they still may occasionally raid some sort of homestead somewhere, but in general, they prefer the diet that they've adjusted to over a millennia.
Really interesting. You mentioned this population is it only at 50 animals. Now that sounds pretty desperate. Is it fairly stable or has it been going downhill?
We presume that it's fairly stable. The real answer to that is that we don't really know. Part of the previous park leadership where most of these bears exist were very protective of the bears and would not let scientists come in and do a count. The result is we have probably 30, 35 years of kind of verbal estimates from a couple people who say, oh, no, this is how many there are. But there's no data to support that at all. In the last 10 years, though, there's been, with a change of leadership at the park, there's been very intensive scientific study, largely through hair samples, fecal samples, where they can DNA track, and they come up with a number of around 50 bears. The real concern is that they may be closer to 38 to 40. And then the biggest concern is that they estimate that there are between 12 and 13 breeding females. That's important because when you get down to 6 or 7, you're talking about a species that likely cannot persist over time because of genetic degradation.
Yeah. Now, the man you were saying who ran the national park, Tassi, yes. He was absolutely devoted to saving these bears. And really, because he was such an autocrat and was so protective of the bears, he may have actually really harmed their long-term viability.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we'll never know for sure, right? Because on the one, Franco Tassi is a legend. Even, he's He was a legend in Italy. He ruled with an iron fist. He's also charming. He didn't want anyone to disturb these bears. He loved the bears. There's pictures with him with these bears. And he's a lovely man in many ways, but he was ousted after a scandal with all sorts of suggestions of embezzling state funds and wiretapping and all this stuff. The question is whether or not his hyper-protectionist stance actually sowed the seeds of the demise of these bears. Because
he really didn't let outside biologists in.
He was highly skeptical. He felt that the outside biologists were simply padding their careers and seeking out their publications or money or something. And the result is that he didn't want anyone else touching them. Now, of course, some of the scientists now think, you know, was he hiding the fact that these bears were in trouble? I don't buy that after speaking to Tassi. I think Tassi to this day maintains that when he left the park in 2002, there was between 120 and 150 bears, which would mean that in the last 10 years or so, the population has plummeted. There is no concrete evidence that that is the case, and I'm skeptical of those numbers, even though I respect that he had his own way of doing counts that may have led him to that conclusion.
Now, one of the good ways of protecting this bear is creating a subspecies for this particular bear. I know that's been you go into that in the book.
Yeah.
Is there good evidence that this is actually a subspecies of your typical brown bear?
Yes, this is a different bear. There's no question. And now that scientists are being allowed in to study these bears, we're getting more and more evidence to that. The genetic makeup is different. The morphology of the head is utterly different because they're vegetarians and have been for 1,000 years. They have smaller heads, or bodies are a little bit smaller. The jaw bones are different. The muscle structure in the mouth is different. The snout is different. Even things down to the mitochondria are different in these bears from the typical brown bear. Now, whether or not that is deserving of a categorization, part of what I want to say in the book is that one of the reasons it's worth considering renaming them, keep in mind they previously had a subspecies categorization is stripped of them. One reason to reapply that is that brown bears as a whole are not endangered. The minute you give them this subspecies designation, you can give them an endangered species label, and the result is there's all sorts of different funding available to study and preserve the bears that right now are not available.
Now, in the United States, I know that is an incredibly political decision. Is it the same in Italy?
It is. And in fact, what I would say is that this is not a decision to be made in Italy. And, you know, the scientists that I spoke with in Italy it is not their goal to get the subspecies recategorization. Instead, they just want to figure out the best process for preserving these bears since they are on the precipice or close to extinction. The real politics of it comes in the scientific community. And for however wonderful science is in moving us towards progressive new ideas and making us rethink things, it can be a creaking old machine when it comes to trying to change how we think about and how we call certain animals. And I think in this case, that's what some folks are going to be up against.
My guest today is Roger Thompson. He is the director of the program in Writing and Rhetoric at Stony Brook University. He also was a founder of an environmental program in Banff, Alberta, and his new book is titled No Word for Wilderness, Italy's Grizzlies and the Race to Save the Rarest Bears on Earth. It's published by Ashland Creek Press. He's a Tulsa native, by the way, and he is our guest today. You know, you were talking about the native northern Italy bear population that died out.
Yes.
Is it thought that they were very similar to the Abruzzo bears at one point, where they might have been vegetarians, they might have had this a different morphology?
Yeah, so they definitely were a little bit different than the largest population of brown bears in Italy or in Europe. The question is how much. Not as distinctive as the Apennine. At some point, the bears in the Alps got isolated from the Apennine bears, and those populations both retreated to certain areas, particularly the Alpine bears retreated to an area of Italy called Trentino, whereas the Apennine bears continued to recede till they ended up in Abruzzo.
Yeah. One of the things that's been working in the bears' favors is Italians are really not interested in going to the wilderness. You know, if they go to Abruzzo, it's to go to the Adriatic beaches.
That's right.
On the other side. There's not a whole lot of people looking other than maybe wildlife biologists
yes,
and people such as yourself.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is one of the things I point out in the book. And, I'm, you know, it's tough. It's tough to make generalizations about any culture, just as it would be about Americans. But I feel fairly comfortable in saying that whereas we have in America a certain ethic towards, hey, let's go camping. You know, we have the tradition of the Boy Scouts and everything attendant to that, you know, even since Teddy Roosevelt's era or John Muir. You don't have the same traditions. In fact, you have the opposite traditions where the wilderness, the wild spaces were areas of threat, right? And the goal was to settle them. And if you couldn't, you built villages high on mountaintops where the things that were down in the woods and the forest could not bother you. So there is a way in which the fact that the Italians aren't interested in the wild as much has probably put them off the radar of some people once they receded to a certain degree.
Yeah. Now, you contrast that with another story in the book of Bruno the Bear. Yeah. If you were following the World Cup in 2000 and what was it? 2006 in Germany, this sort of became a sub-story that almost was equal to the World Cup in some ways. And it's about Bruno the Bear, who was one of the Slovenian transplant grizzlies that actually came into Germany.
That's right.
From Austria into Germany. Mm-hmm. And actually was perhaps the first brown bear in Germany.
150 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you want to tell this story? Because I think it gets into the attitudes of Europeans towards wildlife and how they think about, you know, a species, yes, an apex species like a brown bear.
Yeah. So Bruno was an interesting, he was a Slovenian. He was born of a Slovenian sow in northern Italy. He's part of the Trentino reintroduction program. And after about 2 years old, he wandered north into Germany. And there he became a problem. He'd actually been a problem before that a bit. He had been raiding various farmsteads and chicken coops and such. And then he started killing sheep. And the problem with Bruno was that he was killing animals and not devouring them. And to many people, this appeared to be he just kind of killing for sport, for the joy of it. You know, that's a certain degree of kind of anthropomorphic idealization of kind of the danger of the bear.
But obviously there was something going on with the bear because the bear was not consuming any of the carcasses.
That's right. There was real problems. And, you know, he wasn't doing some of the normal things. You know, sometimes a bear will slay an animal and then, you know, leave and come back and feed on it. Bruno didn't do that. And he would kind of kill and move along. So the German officials very quickly became concerned about this. And which one of the more striking things about German fascination and disgust with this bear is that I really do think if the World Cup wasn't going on, they would have been more patient with this bear. They would have done more to capture it and relocate it. They may not have even bothered with it. They might have just seen what would have been going on. But at the time, the German media and international media latched on to Bruno's exploits. And in during the World Cup, the newspapers ran more stories about Bruno until he was later killed. They ran more stories on Bruno than they did on the World Cup. And the most popular internet video game of that year, 2006, was a game called Hunt for Bruno. And the whole point of it was to make fun of German officials' inability. And the German population, you know, took great joy in knowing that this great, efficient, powerful nation was unable to catch this bear. And so the result is, you know, Bruno became kind of a pariah.
And Bruno, you know, I contrast that how Americans would have treated a grizzly bear or even a black bear that was exhibiting the same behavior.
Yep.
We wouldn't have thought twice about it.
Yep.
We would have killed the bear.
Yes.
We would have either captured and euthanized it because this was a bear that had no fear of humans.
Right.
At one point it was sitting on the steps of a police station.
Yes. And one of the great ironies that the police were out looking for the bear and the bear wandered into a town and made himself comfortable on their front door. It was their front steps. It was, you know, you can't write these things.
But he was making kills within a couple hundred feet of tourists.
Yes, absolutely. And he, you know, I've got good friends who are bear naturalists of various stripes and you know, there's still very mixed opinion on whether or not Bruno was handled correctly. For me, the issue ultimately came down to is that Bruno became such a celebrity that people who had no business going out and looking for him, right, including young people, were scouring the German countryside. You know, and these are people who are coming into the country for the World Cup. And so, you know, for me, it was inevitable. In my mind, looking back, it seems fairly inevitable that there was going to be some sort of human-bear conflict there.
Right.
But not everyone's convinced of that. One of my good Bear Naturalist friends points out that he at no point exhibited any of the danger behavior that you know bears to do. No woofing, no snapping of the jaw, no charges, no false charges, nothing, right? Even when people were close. So he felt that the bear had just gotten habituated, but was not dangerous and should not have been treated the way it was. Nonetheless, there's lots of people, even within the bear community, who think Bruno's time was probably at an end.
Yeah. And so you tell this story in contrast to the Abruzzo bears. For what reason?
I want people to understand that we can't generalize, just like we can't generalize populations of people, we can't generalize populations of bears. And if we are willing to not generalize those different populations, then we may see value in preserving certain types of animals, even though they look like other types of animals. And in this case, the Abruzzo bears, these bears can be a lesson to us for how to live alongside wild animals in very settled lands. And it really can, you know, there's ways in which the Italian Abruzzo bears can be a model for us, especially now. We've got lots of stuff going on about grizzly work currently, and law rollbacks and stuff, which all presume that the bears are inherently dangerous, inherently need culling, because they can't live alongside people. And it's just fundamentally not true. That doesn't mean that the American bear, the American grizzly of the West, it is a different creature, and it has a long reputation of being more aggressive and less tolerant of certain intrusions into its land. But that doesn't mean we can't look at models like what we see with the Abruzzo bears and try to figure out, okay, well, what is it that we can do to kind of facilitate this relationship?
Do we think for whatever reason this particular subspecies of bear just was more adaptable? Or you know, evolved to be more adaptable around humans?
That's a good question. Certainly the degree of contact they must have had. Again, the 50 miles east of Rome, and keep in mind, the Romans loved bringing in bears to slaughter in front of large crowds. So it may be this is utter conjecture on my part, right? It may be there's a degree of selection there, right, where the more timid or less aggressive bears were not seen and were harder to find and persisted, right? So that's certainly a possibility, but I don't think that explains it enough. I think there's something about these bears, especially in the way that their diet adapted, right, where their need to eat and survive necessitated their diet changing from what most bears or what we conceive of most bears. It's worth noting that bear populations have different diets. I mean, we think of some in the Northwest, they're largely fish eaters, right? Yeah.
They eat trout, they eat moths, they eat pine nuts.
Yep, yeah, absolutely.
That's the three main components, and berries.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, you will see oftentimes that even if in the Rockies, you'll find huge turned over rocks, right? And in places, and you think, oh, that's just fallen down. No, it's a bear's been there, and they're looking for ant colonies or beetles or different types of what are called forbs, a certain type of grassy weed. And bears eat a lot of vegetation, regardless of their location.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book. The name of it is No Word for Wilderness. Roger, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a real pleasure.
Roger Thompson is the author of No Word for Wilderness, Italy's Grizzlies and the Race to Save the Rarest Bears on Earth. It's published by Ashland Creek Press. Thompson is a native Tulsan and now the director of the program in Writing and Rhetoric at Stony Brook University. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.